Is this a paper? No. Sorry. Thanks, Megan. I'm going to call the tax committee to order here in a sec. We're just waiting for the tape. Sorry about that. Okay, thank you, Megan. Good morning. The tax committee is called to order today. Members, before we get started, I'm going to pass around some information that I'm not sure what it is. I was asking Joel Michael to tell us maybe what it is. When I was in a fiscal chairs meeting, Representative Rukavina showed us a budget book from the 80s and showed us what Governor Perpich, I guess, used to prepare or have his staff prepare. And it was kind of interesting. So then Representative Junkie told me that up in the legislative reference library, there's all kinds of good stuff in all the areas. So we asked for the legislative reference library to send us some of the older stuff for the tax committee. And it's just kind of interesting to see. Maybe Mr. Michael, just now glancing at us, can tell us what these are. There's three of them. And I thought maybe it was the budget book, but I don't think it is. So, Mr. Michael. I just sprung this on him, so.
Yeah. I'm sure you have to give me more time to look at this. The oldest one is from 1914, and it's a biennial report of the Minnesota Tax Commission, and it has all sorts of...
One Carlson on there?
Yeah.
Yeah?
If you want to see interesting things like, you know, how many, what the percentage increase in the number of stallions in the city of New Prague is in here.
That's a one. Look at that. New Prague, number of stallions, yes.
These other reports of the Revenue Department, which was, some of us who've been here for a long time can remember when these were sort of a fixture, but they have declined in importance recently. I can pass these around if people
yes,
want
please.
To
yeah, so thank you. Thank you, Mr. Michael. And so people, members, just take a look at them. They're kind of interesting. But a few of them would have been what the commissioner, you might look at them yourself, commissioner, and then be glad you don't have to prepare these anymore. But they're just kind of interesting to see. So with that, we're going to go back to the commissioner, if you'll just join us. And I think we're up to the property tax area. And then, commissioner, I don't know if anyone was able to be in contact with you this morning from our staff. We're going to try to take a recess for about 15 minutes and come back again. And DFL taxes will meet, and I think, I'm not sure if Representative Broad is going to have Republican taxes meet, but we've got a room set up for her to do that if she wants as well. But we thought we'd go through a little bit, take a recess, and come back and do the rest and take public testimony.
Okay. So, Madam Chair,
good morning.
Good. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Inans with the Department of Revenue, and I think we left off. We just started, we're about to start the property tax provisions of the governor's recommendations. I thought before I went into the individual, and it started on page 14 of the change pages, I just talked about the basic structure of how we structured the LGA County Program Aid and market value credit cuts. Those who served on this committee in 03 will remember the county program LGA market value credit reductions we did in 03, and we structured these in a similar manner. So we backloaded the cuts in the second year, two-thirds of the cut in the second year, one-third in the first year, in acknowledgement that many cities and counties don't have much budgetary flexibility in the current calendar year, so that the cuts are backloaded. We also capped for jurisdictions the amount that they can lose as a percentage of their levy plus 8, similar to what we did in 03. And for cities, in the first year, that percentage is 5.05%, and in the second year, it's 10.55%. And then for the counties, we expect it to be 1.53% of levy plus 8, the reduction, the maximum amount of reduction. And then in the second year, 2.8%. Now, there's a little bit of a wrinkle there in the county program aid. You've heard about the efforts to consolidate some of the health care delivery systems. If the counties do that, they can earn back a portion of their cut. And our expectation is, based on the numbers that are in the change stages, is that they will meet those benchmarks and they will earn back, or I guess earn back is the right word, a percentage of their cut. And Commissioner Wilkin is here from DHS to talk about that in more specifics if you want, because DHS is the architect of that provision. My understanding of the benchmarks is this, that in November of this year, the counties will need to indicate to the Department of Health and Human Services that they intend to participate in the consolidation, If they do that, they earn back a percent of the cut. In June of next year, they'll need to have passed a resolution and send that to the Department of Health and Human Services, indicating that they're working towards that consolidation. And then the following year, they'll have to have entered into a joint powers agreement with their other counties. And if they meet that benchmark, they will once again earn back a percentage of the cut. So it's an attempt to incentivize some of these counties to participate together to consolidate some of their delivery, health and human services delivery systems into 15 rather than 87 delivery systems. And if you want more detail on that, I can bring down Commissioner Tim Wilkins. So that's how we structured it. As you know, from 2003, the market value credit was also part of the equation. And we wanted to make sure as many jurisdictions as possible had some skin in the game. So even those cities that don't get an ELGA or are not heavily LGA-dependent will lose a portion of their market value credit. In some instances, they'll lose all their market value credit, and they'll also be subject to the cap that I referenced earlier. So that's how we structured it. It's very similar, very analogous to what we did in 2003. Now I'll walk through the individual change stages, if I may, Madam Chair. And the first stage is page 14, which is the county program aid reduction. And that, as you can see, that's in FY 2010, that's a $42.7 million reduction in county program aid and an $83 million reduction in 2011. And as I said before, that represents in year one, 1.53% of levy plus aid, and in year two, 2.8% of levy plus aid. And represents approximately
20%. Excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Wapper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, the precedence of using county aid, which has been like local government aid use, is defined as a property tax relief, as a means for forcing consolidation of services is really precedent setting. And to do it within tax policy when it's really about human services implementation as opposed to the human service funding stream seems to be an odd choice. And so if you could address a little bit why you think tax policy should be the basis for doing that, and why did you ever consider similar sort of approaches for schools and cities? I mean, I think we've always believed in local control and creating incentives for efficiency and partnership, but I've never seen a property tax relief used as a tool to force a consolidation.
Madam Chair, Representative, we did look at the waterfront as far as other places we could incentivize consolidation. This one seemed to jump out at the governor and at the folks at DHS, just because 87 different delivery systems just didn't seem like the optimum number when you have the 87 counties. So it just seemed like an obvious one from our perspective. We understand it's a precedent setting, and I think this session needs to be precedent setting on a whole bunch of fronts. I mean, if we should be setting precedent this session. I mean, we need to do things differently. We need to try to push the envelope as far as optimizing efficiencies, whether it's a DHS delivery system, whether it's state government. So I'm not as concerned about setting a precedent. I think we need to set some precedent this session. You're right. I mean, it's in general, we have not tied these kind of performance measurements to receipts of local government aid. That's true. But this aid is going to fund core services. And if in conjunction with funding those core services, we can make them more efficient, I think that's a good thing. And sometimes people call it a stick or a carrot approach. Sometimes that's necessary to get all the parties at the table. As you know, and I know, there are parochial and turf issues within every county and every jurisdiction. And sometimes it requires a little bit of nudging and maybe a little bit of fiscal incentive in order for people to maybe look beyond their own parochial interests and say, you know what, this is the right thing for the state. We can go to 15 delivery systems. DHS is still working out the details. They're talking to the county folks. The county folks have not dismissed this out of hand. And we understand some of the larger counties, they're going to be delivery system in and of themselves. I mean, Hennepin County, no one's going to ask them to consolidate with another county. They are large enough, and the efficiencies are probably already there. But I think we need to explore some of these possibilities out there, and tying some dollars to it, I think, is going to raise the profile a bit. And I think the counties have not dismissed it out of hand, and they know there's an opportunity there.
Mr. Walker.
Well, Madam Chair and Commissioner, with due respect, I do think we have to talk about, you know, what's the right and proper place. Even if you believe that there needs to be incentives for consolidation, I think there already are. I chair, co-chair with Linda Burke on a committee in which the Department of Human Services participates to look at administrative streamlining within human services. And I came with certain expectations about those sparsely populated rural counties that were having challenges in terms of just having large enough caseloads to be efficient. And I was really impressed by how almost all of them are part of a multi-county and this delivery system. They are not 87 delivery systems in Minnesota. They are actually multi-county partnerships in almost all aspects of human service delivery. And so the premise is a little wrong, but I think in terms of how much there are 87 systems, I don't think there are. But the other thing, though, is I think that it really is an issue for the Human Services Committee to really talk about how to best organize and how long should someone have to drive to get services and all those sorts of things. And it just seems to me an awkward fit to put it into what has been property tax relief in part based on equalizing tax burdens between jurisdictions. And so I think that all of us, as we wrestle with this issue, should, it's not even just about the merits of it, the case itself, but also whether this is the right jurisdiction, because if this committee is going to make a ruling on it, it really does need to get into the weeds on, you know, how far do we think someone who has a disabled child should have to drive to be able to get an assessment for eligibility for a public program, or how far should it be between mental health clinics, and, you know, all the kinds of things that, that Health and Human Service Committee members deal with on a much too frequent basis.
Yes, sir. Madam Chair, Representative Wofford, I couldn't agree more, and I would expect that the Health Human Services Committee are going to weigh in very heavily on the substance of this debate and are going to be front and center, because I know this committee, and this is new territory for this committee as far as weighing in on this. I will say this, I think, and I'm outside my realm of expertise by a long shot talking about the Health Human Services delivery system, but my understanding is, based on the companies I have been privy to, is that it's not necessarily about shrinking the footprint out there as far as where somebody would have to drive to get a service or anything. It's about consolidating HR functions, consolidating IT functions, not having 87 HR departments, not having 87 IT departments, consolidating some of the back office stuff, not necessarily contracting the footprint of number of offices or locations where people can go and get services. So I think we got to go through deep into the weeds and make sure we're not doing anything that has unintended consequences to delivery. But I think the intent behind this is to shrink some of those back office functions, or consolidate them, I should say, not necessarily the footprint or where the services are ultimately delivered.
Madam Chair, and not to turn this into a debate on it yet before we have the bill in front of us, but I do have to say that we're still going to have 87 counties, as I understand, on this proposal, who will still have their own HR function for the county sheriff and for all the other people who work for county government. It's not about HR, and it's not about IT, because, quite honestly, the computer systems that counties use are developed and run by the State Department of Human Services throughout the whole state of Minnesota, and they're the most inefficient, ancient systems you could ever imagine. They actually have all green screens with numbers, no English on, even though they have color monitors, and they haven't been upgraded and don't talk to each other across different programs. So if we were going to make human services more efficient, I think the first place we might start with is the IT out of DHS that all counties are using and dependent upon.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I wouldn't have to do with any of that, Representative Wofford. I guess the question I would have, if you were starting from scratch, would you develop a system that is 87 different Health Human Service Delivery Systems, or whatever the number may be? Would you start based on what really are arbitrary municipal county boundaries? Is that, if you were starting and wanted to make the optimal, most efficient system at delivering services to your taxpayers, is that what you would come up with? And I think most people would say probably not. And can we unwind that? Not totally. I'm sure we can't. I mean, there's 87 counties for a reason. There's loyalties to those counties. There's parochial differences. But I think we need to revisit it, and I think there's a general acknowledgement that it probably isn't the ideal system right now. And that's the hope, is this discussion will spur that.
That's kind of my part. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and a little bit on what Representative Wofford was talking about. I know there are some rural counties that are already consolidating or combining their health and human services delivery systems. Lincoln, Ryan, and Murray is one group, and Faribault and Martin also combine their services. Since they are maybe already ahead of the curve somewhat, would they already qualify for this reduction in cuts? And the fact that they've combined already?
You know, Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, I know that they're the ones that combined because Representative Schreifer doesn't tire telling us that his counties have already consolidated to a certain extent. But I'm not sure about that. I'd have to defer that to Tim Wilkins, who's actually available to answer that question. But I don't know if that would meet the threshold or not.
Right, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, and yes, welcome, Assistant Commissioner Wilkins. Members who do not know Mr. Wilkins, former legislator, former member of the Tax Committee. Nice to see you. And Commissioner, I do think that Representative Marquardt's raising a really important point. I mean, I you know, hear from my own city on some of these consolidation efforts. Now, this isn't counties, but the old penalize, you know, punish the people who are being frugal, punish the people who are not hitting levy limits. That there's been a past history around here that sometimes folks are already doing these things do not benefit when proposals come forward to say, you know, you're going to get a benefit if you do this. Well, a whole bunch of local units of government are already doing this stuff. And then how do they win under the governor's proposal? Do they qualify for enhanced aid? So welcome. Nice to see you, Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim Wilkins, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Human Services. The short answer to your question is they don't necessarily just by being involved in the current Lincoln Lyon Murray partnership qualify. There are certain standards that will be in the bill, certain thresholds that we'll have to reach. The goal is to get to about 100,000 in population. I know Lincoln Lyon Murray in particular is interested in expanding their efforts. I don't think they'll be opposed to this. They work very well. And we've got a goal to get to 15 human services delivery units. And in order to do that, you can't pick off three counties here, three counties there. They're going to have to be a little bigger to get to critical mass. And I know Lincoln Lyon Murray in particular is ready for that and would be welcoming of additional counties.
Representative Marquardt, thank you very much. And I appreciate that answer. And it kind of leads me to another question when we talk about, you know, trying to get 100,000 population or whatever, you know, up in northwest Minnesota. I mean, that's going to require a lot of territory and a lot of counties to mesh that amount of population together. I mean, is that consideration being taken into account, the fact that, I mean, you could have some huge, huge districts that, in fact, might be very difficult to operate because of its size? Is that a consideration, especially in rural areas?
Assistant Commissioner Wilkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Marquardt, it is consideration. The bill doesn't have a map or groupings in it. There's no preconceived ideas of what the regions are going to look like. They could be an affinity group. They could be a couple of northern counties working with some southern counties that are more populous. That's entirely possible. The counties, this is going to be in their lap, and you know, we'll obviously help them, but it will be, they will have a lot of control over this. But the goal is ultimately when they turn in their plans to get to 15, and there's some mechanisms to do that. There will be some potentially large regions that are made. I guess I'd avoid the term region because it doesn't necessarily say that the counties that form together have to be contiguous geographically. They could be affinity groups or such. As far as if they were in a contiguous area, it doesn't mean there has to be one area that they deliver services from. They could have a central administration of the services, and they could have centrally they could deal with some of the more complex things to deliver, like waiver enrollment. But I would anticipate that there would still be a local presence in each county to do certain things like child welfare, where you need people actually walking into homes to check on the children and to deliver certain services. So it's got a lot of flexibility for the counties to determine how they're going to deliver those services.
Thank you.
Good question. Representative Downey, yes.
think that, this is maybe just a comment, I'd like to compliment the commissioner and the governor for taking this bold step. Having done quite a bit of work myself in a past life in some human services agencies in counties and in state and county government in general, I would like to submit maybe a contrary opinion that I think this is the exact right lever. From my perspective, very rarely is there an incentive in government operations to drive towards efficiency and higher customer service absent a shortage of revenues. And you can look at many examples right here in town, Hennepin County, in the aftermath of the LGA cuts in 2003, moved to consolidate what were five separate and distinct health and human services divisions into one operating unit. I think they pulled about $10 million in annual operating costs due to that. So I think maybe a contrary opinion here, you got to do it right, and you got to do it smart, and you got to do it in a way that actually improves the service. But there is a way to redesign these operations and make them more effective, and I think absent an LGA lever like this, I'm not sure that we'd have the tool to try and drive that efficiency into the system. So a comment, and if anybody wants to comment back, great, but I wanted to make sure that opinion was out here before the committee as well.
Thank you, Representative Downey. And I do think, you know, I don't know if you know this, Assistant Commissioner Welkin, but Representative Lanning made some comments on the floor yesterday, and this is a difficult issue for everybody here, and this committee does not understand health and human services. There are a few members who do. I'm not one of them. But this is a big deal for us to grapple with, whether we go down the governor's route or a different one. We need a lot of people around this table bipartisanly figuring this out. I mean, Representative Marquardt's going to be deep into the weeds in his property tax committee. Representative Lanning is the lead of that committee. This is going to be a big struggle, and we need a lot of communication. We're meeting jointly with the health committees next week, the two tax committees with the two health committees tomorrow. I hope you'll be here. We just plain old need a lot of help. I mean, I think it's just going to be very, very difficult in this deficit to figure out what can we remove for maintenance of effort and allow for flexibility, who gets punished in a formula like this, and who gets helped, and why, and based on what. And I honestly do not feel well-suited to make those decisions, and I have not figured out yet even who will ultimately make those decisions. If most of them will happen in the Tax Committee, in the Health and Human Services Committee, I'm not sure. But I've asked people bipartisanly to get involved in this. In fact, I was delighted to hear freshman Representative Anderson, I believe was his name, yesterday on the floor, showing interest in that as well. And we have some people like Representative Downey and Representative Wofler who know a lot about this, Jefferson County Commissioners, like Representative Ann Belf and others, and we're going to need them all on both sides now. And I hope, you know, you will bring everybody forward to get to work on this and quickly, because May is coming real soon, and we all need some help. So I appreciate you being here. Further questions for Representative Wofler?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner. It would be very helpful to me and I think to the rest of the committee. It looks like from the material that's been provided to us that there's a $22 million difference between 100% of the counties participate in the consolidation or zero. And so that takes... That leads me to believe that there's $22 million in efficiency improvements that you think can happen by this consolidation. And I'd really like to get, you know, some of the background of how you came up, what you expect that to be. Because obviously it's more than 72 human service directors lose their jobs, I mean, and a couple of middle management people. It's to get to $22 million in efficiency in a service system that has waiting lists and, you know, that is dealing with increasing caseloads just due to the economic changes that are experiencing right now. Whatever background and research you have on that, how you came to that number would be really helpful.
Assistant Commissioner Wilkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Wofler, right now we haven't nailed down exactly the cost savings that will happen with this, because right now we don't know what the different groupings will be among the counties. The bill you will see is a broad framework. The bill, at least on Word, is about three pages. It's not the two-inch thick bill that you might expect, because there's going to have to be a lot of recodification, a lot of detail to be worked out in the interim. that sets a framework and some mileposts that counties have to meet in order to get to the end goal. It certainly is a complex issue to deal with, and I certainly plan on being around a lot and talking to legislators that are interested in this and making sure we work out the details and get it done right the first time.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Wilkins. But I would also say, if I'm wrong on the $22 million, but at least on the chart they've given us, that's the expected efficiency savings. And so I'd just really like to have you confirm that, and then how you expect us to get near that level of efficiency would be great.
Okay, so you've got that request?
Yep.
Have that tomorrow, right? Just kidding, but it would be nice if you could be here tomorrow. Because we're going to have that broad discussion further. Representative Gardner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I understand Representative Loeffler's concerns, but I think this is actually kind of an intriguing idea, and I think it is appropriate for us to use some tools in the toolbox here. Not, I mean, I don't care whether you call it a carrot or a stick, because the alternative is a really big sledgehammer to counties, and I think we do need to think outside the box, particularly in this year. But I was hoping to set you up for the next page on LGA to see if you've thought of any ways to, I'm thinking of suburban communities, not of greater Minnesota cities, which are different, but of ways that we can, you know, encourage things outside the human services area, like billing, utility billing, and a whole variety of other things. And I've been trying to think of some things too, where cities in my communities are going to see an LGA cut, but if they can, since they get a rebate, or where if they do something smarter, other ways to do that too.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, you know, we did look at a lot of different options, and we'd be very much open if there's something out there that we think that warrants, you know, using maybe the sticker carrot approach to incent some consolidation. We'd be open to that. I think we knew that the county consolidation or the CHS was going to be a very big thing to swallow and a lot of details to work through, so we focused most of our efforts on that. But that's not to say there's not other opportunities out there, and potentially, I'm not going to foreclose reworking the LGA recommendation in light of some consolidation efforts that might come about. So we're certainly open to any and all those suggestions.
Well, Madam Chair, just as a follow-up comment is food for thought. In my suburban community in Ramsey and Anoka County, when you look on how these municipalities were set up 50 years ago and read the history, they are set up for the most arbitrary of reasons. And I come from the East Coast, where a lot of areas are unincorporated. There's very few incorporated cities, and everything is a county. And so I was really surprised 20 years ago to come here and look at a map of the Twin Cities and just see this jigsaw puzzle with two big pieces in the middle and then 150 pieces around it. And as I looked at the history of Shoreview, these guys in Moundsview Township, you know, they didn't want to get together with the guys on the other side of the lake. And so it's Arden Hills and Shoreview, and then in Circle Pines, a bunch of guys from the university wanted to set up a cooperative community that sounded very quasi-socialist, and so the folks across the road in the township created their own city in Lexington, and they called it Lexington, and they had the Minuteman as their logo to show that they weren't like those commies over in Circle Pines. And the streets are Revere Lane and Liberty Lane, and they, you know, so they, but now it's totally flipped, and Lexington is highly dependent on LGA, and Circle Pines has got some affluent areas that allow it to do well without the credits. But for whatever reason, they are separate entities, and they're all wondering how they're going to survive, and I'm not suggesting that we merge them necessarily, but my gosh, they have different fire departments and billing systems and whatever, and if they're going to survive, I mean, this is the year to help figure them out how to do it.
Thank you. Representative Colbert.
Just a little bit of warning. I spoke to the little mayor of Bolivie, and right next to us was Polarain. I had a suggestion to merge the volunteer fire departments. I went into the volunteer fire department and came out tarred, feathered, and hung. Be careful. I also got reelected, but I was after I took the tar feather off.
That's from Ruth Amina.
Drive up the feather industry.
And Pura, you know, in my
do I sense a defeatist attitude here, Madam Chair? Are we already given up that the governor's budget is the governor's budget? I thought we were going out for hearings. So, you know, I mean, there's proposals in here regarding local government aid, Representative Gardner, but we're still in charge of the legislative branch anyway, and we get to make decisions and proposals because, you know, there's really, Commissioner, there's a lot of unfairness in the share the pain concept for the governor. And I'll give you a good example, and for those new members, I know if you can believe this, but I actually flipped out one day in committee. You know, I know I normally don't do that, but you were there, Representative Winchesky, when the new local government aid formula got created, and I don't know where my buddy Garofalo is. Oh, there you are. And as I said the other day, I mean, a formula is a formula you write because you want to send money to certain areas. So when I kind of flipped out that day in 2003 when I asked about the fairness and the cuts, you know, I look at this sheet again, and I see that the city of Hoyt Lakes that was built for a particular mining company. There was no city there in 1955. No, nothing. It was for it. And it became the city of Hoyt Lakes, and now under the local government aid formula, Commissioner, they're going to, in the second year, you lose 51% of the local government aid, merely because of that fair formula where pre-1950, whatever it is, 50 or 55 homes, take into are a big part of the formula. So, Commissioner, where is the fairness in a community like Hoyt Lakes that lost the only industry it has? And no, everybody, there's nothing. I think there's a bowling alley and a bar, and that's their CI base. And so the only other base they had, and the only other jobs they had, were a mining company, and they're going to lose, it looks like their certified LGA is 457, and they're going to lose 239 of it in 2010. So where is the fairness in that share of the pain concept?
Mr. Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, we did our utmost to spread these cuts in a way, and there's 270 some cities in the state of Minnesota. Is that right? I can't remember now. But so we tried to spread these in a way that was as equitable as we could, considering the budget constraints we had. We capped the amount that they can lose as a percentage of levy plus aid, so no community was disproportionately impacted. The reality is, though, some communities are heavily dependent on LJ, others are not. And there's the inequities you see in the run you have in front of you is a function of that. I mean, Edina doesn't get any LGA, no surprise there, and when they also lose all their market value credits under the governor's proposal. You can't take any more than they have. So we've taken everything we can from Edina, from Lakeville, from some of the affluent communities. Those communities that are more LGA dependent are going to see a larger cut. It's a function of the formula. It's a function of the revenues they receive. Now, we can revisit the 2003 LGA formula, the reforms that were made there, and there's a group meeting to do that. But I would assert that the formula we have today is far more fair and equitable than the one that predated 2003, because the 2003 formula was heavily dependent on the grandfather. And so no matter what the changing circumstances were out in communities, they grandfathered in a large portion of the money. So I think that the formula we have today is more responsive to changing circumstances, responsive to changing tax capacities, responding to changing needs in each city. And we can argue about some of the factors that we ultimately arrived at. But they weren't picked out of thin air. We did regression analysis at the department. We tried to identify those factors that are determinative of need. And people can disagree about whether we got the right ones. But I think all I can do is say, compared to the pre-2003 formula, the formula we have today is better. Can it be improved on? Absolutely. Is there a group working to do just that? Absolutely there is. I think they're going to come back next year, actually, with their recommendations. But it's a challenge. There's a finite number of dollars that go out on the LGA formula.
I'm sure there is a group that can work on it, Commissioner, and they're called legislators. And maybe we should revisit it because, again, I don't think it's fair for... And I'm just picking Hoyt Lakes. It's in my district. Used to be in Senator Bach's House district. But it's not fair that a community that suffered that much loses 51% of the revenue. And you're right. You know, the 2001 tax bill changed a lot of things. But there's a certain part of it that, you know, you forgot to mention, and that is that, you know, the Golden Crescent over there of Edina, Eagan, and Eden Prairie got about $100 million of the $800 million a year in new K-12 spending, and I don't see any proposal by the governor to revisit that yet. In a deal cut by then-Majority Leader Tim Pawlenty and Speaker Swigum regarding the White Lakes and LTV thing, there's a 66% cut for the mining companies in a deal that was cut by the governor in the 2001 tax bill. So why didn't he cut the other businesses that got money in the 2001 tax bill on the education formula? 66%. I'm talking about 22 cents there.
Right.
Bought on LTV. So why didn't he do that then? Since you bought it for Edina, and I certainly don't want to pick on Edina, I haven't noticed.
And I have to, Commissioner, before I answer, I want to correct Representative Ruzovina. It's called the Fertile Crescent, and I'm in that too. But no, we always called it the Fertile Crescent. That's what you're referencing, and it is, you know, the Bloomington, Eden Prairie, Dinah, Minnetonka, and yes, they have very large net tax capacities, and they are able to levy with very minimal effort on their residents. Taxes. So they're in a better situation, as Representative Ruzovina rightly points out.
Sure.
That they've got a pretty nice net tax capacity, and they don't receive aid, nor should they.
My constituents understand gold. When they talk about fertile, they think about having kids. So, you know, I think Golden Crescent is much more appropriate.
but I think, Commissioner, that, you know, Representative Ruzovina is raising the point, and you are, I think, confirming it, that it's hard to take it away when you're not getting it. But Representative Ruzovina is right. I mean, if you have to buy a fire truck in my city or in Representative Ruz's city, you can go out and per head. Pretty inexpensive, mm-hmm. because we can pass a whole bunch of that burden on CI properties, and we have a large net tax capacity, where if you go off to Dilworth or somewhere, it's pretty tough to buy that hook and ladder truck. Not a lot to pass it on to, and that's what LGA is for, so that people have somewhat similar affordable services, basic core government services, with somewhat similar tax burdens on those residents. And so, you know, we are an equalizing state, and we have a long history of that, and I think, you know, Representative Ruzovina is just now talking about, you know, efforts at the formula. I see the governor's not proposing changing the formula, but, you know, did you want to respond further to Representative Ruzovina?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Ruzovina, maybe just on the LGA formula very quickly. I mean, it is a zero-sum game. So every time we tweak the formula, there's a winner for every loser. And so that's why I think it takes some time and some real thoughtful deliberation to come up with a formula that can get the kind of political buy-in that we need to get. I don't think without the budget cuts in 2003, we would have redone the formula. But I think scarcity breeds innovation, and scarcity breeds looking at things in a new way. You can go through the runs and find inequities. There's no question about it. When you're dealing with 270-some different fact patterns and different communities and different tax bases and different tax capacities and different needs and different, you know, burdens, there's going to be some inequities you can point out. But we did the best we could to spread the pain around in as even-handed a way as we could. And you can find some fault in within the runs, I'm sure. But, you know, you're trying to treat everybody as fair as possible in a kind of a mechanism that spreads the pain around. And we did the best we thought we could, considering the governor's priorities.
Thank you. Representative Lanning, then Cole. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to the question that Representative Gardner raised, and he has talked to me about this as well, and that is what we can do to facilitate more cooperation, coordination, consolidation, even some merger among local units of government. And I just learned, surprisingly, that we do have provision in law that remained in the law even though we did away with the Board of Government Innovation and Cooperation. It was related to that. We disbanded that against my objection back in 2003, but there are some provisions related to that law that are still there, and I think has the potential of being more activated so that it can really provide some tools and some opportunity for more cooperation and consolidation among local units of government. And so as a part of the work group that I'm chairing, we're going to pursue this some more and look at what can we do to help bring about and facilitate more cooperation, coordination, even merger among local units of government.
Thank you. Okay, that represents Holt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rukavina, I think that your comments about the legislature's ability to engage in this and the appropriateness of us doing so is spot on, and I'm looking forward to the chance when we can, you know, we can have a full debate. I mean, we've spent now several days, appropriately so, here, you know, picking over the governor's budget proposal with a fine-tooth comb, and Representative Rukavina, I think you're the only one on your side of the aisle thus far, at least in the House, that's had the courage to come out and talk about the taxes that you do think we should be increasing. But you know, Majority Leader Sertich had an op-ed in the Star Tribune over the weekend talking about the need for more revenue, but nobody wants to talk about where it's coming from. And so, well, you may think that there's too much pain here. I'm looking forward to seeing the proposal from the majority as to how we're going to resolve this. And specifically, Representative Rukavina, and Madam Chair, you mentioned that we have had a history of trying to equalize here in Minnesota, and I think that's a commendable history. However, I think that one of the things we have failed to do, and I think one of the things we need to start to do, is not just look at the revenue side of the balance sheet. If you take a look at, and it's by no means a perfect example, but take a look at the city of Howard Lake, Representative Rukavina, right above White Lakes on the Run. They've got a population that's 100 people more than White Lakes, and they have, if you use certified LGA and levy as a proxy, it's not perfect, but as a proxy for city spending, they're spending about $400,000 a year less than what White Lakes is. And if you do that per capita, that's a couple hundred bucks ahead. And if you do that and you look at all of the cities and how much cities are spending on a per capita basis, it's all over the board, Representative Rukavina. I took one of these earlier spreadsheets and took a look at that, and the average spending per capita by cities is somewhere in the $450 range, and it doesn't seem to, there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason. There are cities up in your up on the range, Representative Rukavina, that spend $1,000 ahead, and there are cities that spend $700 ahead, and there are cities, small cities in southeastern Minnesota and small cities near the suburban areas that spend similar amounts and vastly different amounts. There doesn't seem to be a lot of rhyme or reason to that. And if we're going to talk about equalizing revenues and capacity, I think we should be taking a look at what cities are spending the money on as well. And so I do think there's two sides to the balance sheet. And Representative Rukavina, I applaud your willingness to come forward with a tax increase proposal. I don't support it, but I appreciate the fact that you're putting it on the table so we can have the debate. And I look forward to not only the appropriate critical analysis that we're doing of the governor's budget proposal here and the LGA and county aid reduction, but what's the alternative? If you don't like this, what's the alternative?
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Cole, you know, I've got my own ideas. Whether I can get enough votes to pass them is another story, but the governor himself has admitted he needs more revenue. And I don't think that, he needs $1 billion, and he's changed his mind on the federal money, which is good. At first he didn't want any of it, and now he's trying to, you know, do a little balancing of the budget with that. But he's admitted he needed revenue too, and that's what I've said to you on this committee, and I've said in my committee, and I've said in other committees. We're not going to solve this budget problem by just cutting. We need revenue. It's a question of, you know, whose revenue do we want? You know, I got an old friend, I used to say the only good taxes are the ones your neighbor pays, and I agree with that, especially when it comes from you, Representative Cole. So, you know, so you're a good neighbor. Like State Farm, same thing, you know.
Okay, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Rukavina, I hope you feel I'm a good neighbor too. from Edina.
Sure,
I think so.
I forgot he was on the committee.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, Representative Ruth over there, too. Representative Downey, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. So I guess at the risk of having prescription drugs thrown in, I wanted to just clarify that, I don't know, you made a comment about tens or hundreds of millions of dollars coming to the Edina schools, and I just wanted to let people know that we, I think, have 70% of Minnesota school districts funded at a higher level than Edina Public School, so we are maybe in the golden crescent there, but not in terms of school funding. And I'd also offer to Representative Rukavina, maybe we could have a cup of coffee and talk about a joint powers agreement between Edina and Virginia, and if we couldn't find a way to touch some costs out of the system overall.
Well, you can use our ambulance service. We can lower your population.
Okay, so, Mr. We're going to keep going. Little tidbit, though, little segue. Representative Downey and I, our fathers, taught at the Edina Public Schools together. So, imagine that. We had this link before we met each other, our fathers, through our fathers. So. Commissioner, please.
Madam Chair.
I guess we'll go on to LGA then, since we're on it. Right?
Madam Chair, and on page 15 is our recommendation on local government aid. And as I said before, it's capped at a percent of levy plus aid for each year. And it represents a 23% reduction in the LGA appropriation for the biennial. The next page includes the residential homestead market value credit reimbursement, and this we're also reducing, and this is an effort to kind of spread some of the pain around as far as budgetary pain to those communities that aren't LGA dependent or don't receive any LGA. As you can see, this is $32.7 million in 2010 and $35.8 in 2011. One thing I want to clarify, there's an oversight on my part when we put this package together regarding the townships. The townships are also having their market value credit reduced under this proposal. Unlike the cities and counties, I neglected to put in a cap for the townships. So under the proposal in front of you, about a third of the townships would receive homestead market value credit reduction in excess of 10% of their levy plus aid. That was an oversight on my part, and we will have something in our supplemental budget to correct that, to cap them. They're treated in a like manner to the cities and counties, and that was something that came to my attention after the proposal was put together. So this is the homestead market value credit portion of the reduction, and the following page 17, is the ag market value credit reimbursement, which to a large extent primarily flows to the townships. This is the cut the townships will absorb. Page 18, Madam Chair, is a reduction in the renter's credit. Under current law, this is something the governor has recommended in the past. In current law, it's presumed that 19% of your rent goes to pay property taxes, and that's the presumed percentage that is used to calculate your renter's credit. There was a study done in 2005 by the department which surveyed apartment property taxes, rental property taxes, and it determined that the proper rent percentage of rent paid is closer to 15%. In fact, we concluded 15% or less was the proper calibration for the renter's credit. And in way of some background, in 2001 was the large property tax reform that Representative Rukavina alluded to. And as part of that reform, rental properties got about a 30% reduction in their property taxes. But the 19% was never reduced to reflect that. So 19% stayed at 19%, and we probably should have recalibrated the renter's credit at that time, and we never did. So the renter's credit has morphed into a property tax refund, but also a rent subsidy. And that was the conclusion of the Department of Revenue's findings in 2005. There is quite a bit of variance geographically. Rural Minnesota, the number is closer to 10 or 11%. In the metropolitan area, it can be in excess of 15%. But we think 15% probably represents a pretty good tipping point and would be appropriate to capture where most of the rents are falling at this point. And that raises $50 million.
Excuse me, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm just pondering as I sit here. As a homeowner I have access to the property tax refund. And in addition, I'm able to deduct my property taxes from, and my mortgage interest payments from my taxes. As a renter, I'm eligible for the renter's credit. Am I able to deduct the property taxes that I pay through my rent from my federal or state income taxes?
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, no, you're not. I don't believe you are.
So, Commissioner, there's a differential treatment of like property taxpayers here.
Madam Chair, Representative, with respect to the income tax, yes, there is. Yeah, there is. The only point I would make is that this is intended to be a property tax refund program, and there may be some advocates to say, no, maybe we need a rent subsidy program for some individuals. I would argue this is a very inefficient way of delivering a rent subsidy. If you wanted to do that, you should have a standalone program that is explicitly for that purpose. We're not advocating for that, but I think that would make more sense than having this program not be targeted in the way it's supposed to be targeted, which is to be a property tax refund program. So that's our, you know, prior to 1997, actually, landlords were required to hand over to each tenant exactly the amount of your property tax that you paid. So there was a very accurate calculation. The downside of that, of course, it was very labor intensive both for the landlord and for the department. So in 1997, they went to this presumed percent of rent paid, and we've been there ever since. But we would argue that the percent of rent paid is too high at this point.
Representative, one last follow-up. Commissioner, then would you consider the property tax credit on income tax and the mortgage interest rate deduction on income tax to be a mortgage subsidy program?
Commissioner. Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I would.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner, Representative Dabney, just a thought here. I think Representative Dabney is raising a good point here, and you know, it can be called a wage subsidy. I'll give you that. On the other hand, the property tax system is significantly more burdensome to people of lower means who tend to be renting. They actually pay a higher classification rate in the tax system right out of the gate. You know, homeowners are 1% and they're 1.25. And I think Representative Dabney on the mortgage deduction for interest, that part might not be as fair because they don't hold a mortgage, but the property tax deduction on the state side combined with a higher classification rate, you know, the fact that they can't deduct property taxes paid and they pay a higher classification rate, you know, I think it's legitimate to say this might be a way that the legislature is actually trying to get more money to these people and there should be a different way. But, you know, it's difficult, honestly, to contemplate doing that if the sense is the governor wouldn't support that anyhow. I mean, can you just respond to that? Do you think the governor would support us going back to, you know, you actually have to show taxes paid and then you submit that and you get it, whether you're 10% or 20%, you know, you justify it, you get it, but then you have some sort of program that assists in this regard? Because I do think the housing situation, in particular for renters, is just, it's really at its worst ever since I've been a legislator. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, you know, I can't go on the record here and say yes, the governor will support a rent subsidy program. first of all, it's out of my level, out of my expertise, out of my jurisdiction, but I do think that programs should do what programs were intended to do. And this program was intended to be a property tax refund program. And there is a compelling argument even going back to the pre-97 system. I mean, landlords may hate it, and the department probably wouldn't jump up and down about having to process a much more time-consuming refund, but it would be accurate. It would certainly be accurate, and you know exactly what every individual paid in their property taxes. Beyond that, you know, I can't go on the record and say rent subsidy, but I think programs should do what they're intended to do, and if you really feel strongly about a rent subsidy program, you should put one together that targets at those who really need a rent subsidy. And this gives a rent subsidy to everybody, regardless, pretty much. You know, if you qualify for the renter's credit, you're probably going to get a rent subsidy. Is that an efficient way of targeting scarce resources? I would argue it is not.
And I know you can't, Commissioner, you know, go on record on all these things, but think about this, and, you know, I don't know what Representative Marquardt will do with his committee members, and they've, as you know, had a long discussion about renter's credit already this year, mm-hmm. in committee. Lowering the classification rate if there's going to be some deduction in renter's credit, why not lower the classification rate? But then how do you structure ensuring that the renter gets that as opposed to the landlord? So, I mean, I just hope folks will be flexible in thinking all these difficult pieces through. So, are there others on the renter's credit? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, for clarification, do taxpayers have to report either renter's credit or property tax refund as income?
Commissioner.
Oh, boy. Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I'm going to have to double-check on that. I'm not sure. I know Pat Dalton knows, though. So, Joel.
Mr. Michael.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, no, it is not regarded as income for income tax purposes.
Thank you.
Thank you. PCR that we're on now?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, page 19 is the governor's recommendation to eliminate the political contribution refund. My memory serves me right. I believe this is the third time he's proposed this. As you can see, it raises approximately, $11 million for the biennium. The next proposal, page 20, is to cap the Sustainable Forest Investment Act. This has been a growth program over the last few years, and this proposal in front of you would cap what any individual property owner could get to $100,000. So the vast majority, only four property owners based on our current records, would be impacted by this cap. And it's our understanding that the original intent of this program was to provide an incentive, a per acre payment, that was an incentive to keep these properties forested, and an incentive for small property owners to keep their properties forested. The four largest property owners, you could be argued, don't need that incentive, and that's why we're recommending capping at $100,000 per year. And currently, just in the way of background, members of the committee, the current payment is $8.61 an acre. And the total number of people enrolled in the program is just over 1,000. And the number of acres enrolled is over 7,000 to 8,000 acres. And I don't have my graph with me, but I know that is, actually I do have it here. As I said, it's been a relatively robust growth in this program. In 2005, we paid out about $3.1 million a year. We're scheduled to pay out, I think, close to $8 million a year today.
Sure. Thank you. Representative Bill.
Well, one of the landowners owns about 296,000 acres that receives this payment. I don't know what Representative Solberg, how much?
189,000.
And it was an incentive, it is an incentive to keep the land forested, but it's also an incentive to keep the land so that it is not parcelized out and open to the public. For example, virtually every snowmobile trail in northeastern Minnesota crosses one of these four property owners' lands, of which they give essentially free and open access for man-made snowmobile trails across their land with just a simple written piece of paper, a permit, a one-page document. It's also open these hundreds of thousands of acres to the people from our area, but also from this area for hunting. It's actually considered by most to be quasi public land, that it's not posted, it's open, and that you make comments, you can build a deer stand, a hunt, bear hunt, deer hunt, partridge hunt, and all of those things. But I think the number one most important thing about the Sustainable Forest Initiative Act is, other than the forestry issue that the commissioner talked about, is the parcelization. And I'm certain that if this is capped and if it damages or hurts these four landowners that own hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres of the, what is it, 700 plus thousand acres?
780,000
acres. They will be incentivized then because they don't have the cash flow. These lands aren't owned by people in Minnesota. The largest landowner, I believe, is from Boston, Forest Capital Partners. They used to belong to Boise Cascade. They weren't from Minnesota either. At least they had facilities here in Minnesota. They were from Boise, Idaho. But these people bought it as an investment. And they've been willing to keep it open to the public, open for snowmobile trails, open for hunting, not posted because of these things. And when they don't do that, they're going to take some of the marginal lands that aren't really quality forest lands, and they're going to start selling it. And that may be good for the county in terms of tax capacity. It's going to be terrible for the folks with this committee. Constituents that go up there and expect to go up there. I can tell you what happened with Potlatch. Potlatch, one of the landowners, decided to start leasing land. Now, that land isn't in the SFIA program. And in 1 year, there were thousands of no trespassing signs went up. The city halls and Tower and Cook and Hoare and International Falls and Virginia were inundated by people as, what the heck is going on? We've been hunting on that land for 35 years. My grandfather and great-grandfather hunted on it. And now I went out there and I got in an argument with a guy that's from Maple Grove. And he said he leased the land.
Oh, he was from Edina, right?
Hey, Representative Dallas is listening.
I think you get the point. And I know that we're short of money. Obviously, we're short of money. But, I mean, we made an agreement with these companies. And we made an agreement with the public, with their public money, to keep that land open to the public. And those paper companies have done it. And I see Representative Muller, you know, I'm sure, is up there every weekend hunting deer.
Representative Muller.
Representative Powell.
Okay, so it's Representative Mullery, then Solberg, and Representative Zellers might want to get in on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Mullery.
Representative Joe, I think you were right in the first place, Maple Grove. The people in Edina are too, they're rich enough that they can hire the deer to come down and go by their front window and shoot them.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to emphasize one point that Representative Dill made, and that the ownership of the land isn't the local company anymore. It's located in Minnesota. It's that UPM Kimity owns the land and paper company and owns the 189,000. And they are located in Finland, Helsinki. We visited with them this summer. One of the proposals that they have on the table in their corporate headquarters is to sell the land and parcel it out. And that may be good from a corporate standpoint, but from a public standpoint, if you take 189,000 acres off from recreational land, our people probably won't suffer as much as the people that want to hunt and fish and do all the other things down here. So it's one of the biggest things about the Sustainable Forest Act is it only entails that it have good forest management. So that has to be part of it. That's the biggest thing. But it's also the public access to those lands. And so in effect, you know, if the state owned them, we would be spending money from the state perspective managing the land. Or if we bought it. And it wouldn't be any tax on any tax. Here we have the private companies that are managing the land for their benefit, we don't, but for the also society's benefit.
Well, I think it's also ironic under this set of circumstances that just in November, the public in Minnesota overwhelmingly, which surprised me, voted to increase the sales tax to do exactly what we're going to undo by not funding this program, is to maintain lands that are sensitive, that are important, that are forested, that are wetlands, and that are all those things. And now we're going to undo a program that's done exactly that, and we're going to probably force the hand, very likely force the hand, of those companies that don't either reside in this country or in other parts of the country, thousands of miles away, to say, look, that investment's no longer valid in Minnesota, we're going to sell off the land. When in fact we raised the sales tax to do just the opposite. So at least in part, the sales tax. So, you know, the bill that we passed, I authored the bill in the House that actually passed, it said you can't supplant state money. So it would prohibit using LaSard Heritage Council money, in my estimation, to supplant this money and backfill the governor's recommendation. So, I mean, I don't think someone will say, well, that's the option, we should use the sales tax money to do that, but it said you can't supplant. And so I really look at this as starting down a very, I heard this a million times in here, I hate it, but a slippery slope of really screwing this up.
Thank you. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to a comment my good friend Representative Dill made, he referred to there's LaSard money I'm on the Cultural Heritage Finance Division, and there is no Lessard money. It's Cultural Heritage Finance Division money. Just to correct the record.
Thank you for that, Representative Davis. Representative Zeller.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And although I wasn't up hunting there, I have been asking Representative Dill to maybe fish up in some of those very generous lakes up there. But, Madam Chair, it's a teaching moment for this committee going forward. This is what happens when you mess with tax policy. Businesses, landowners, business owners make decisions. When it comes to the corporate rate, what we spent quite a bit of time talking about, when you do something with the taxpayers' dollars, whether or not it be from the state, from their pocket, they're going to make choices. We've seen this with businesses. We've seen this just last week with, you know, TCF isn't TCF anymore. It's just F from South Dakota. I mean, it's SDF or whatever. This is what happens when we change tax policy. Again, Representative Gill, I agree with you. This is something that if we do, it's going to be awfully difficult. I'm not saying that I, you know, disagree with the governor's need to prioritize our spending, but this is what happens when we change tax policy. Businesses, landowners, people make decisions around how much money they're going to either have to pay or aren't going to be getting from their business. And unfortunately, in this case, I hope we don't get to this place. We find another way. And I know Representative Gill and some of the folks in that area are going to come up with a good alternative for us. And be happy to support the Indian delegation.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just to Representative Zeller's point about TCF, when TCF announced its headquarters move to South Dakota, their spokesperson was explicit that it was not a tax move strategy, that they were doing it for regulation purposes and not taxes. Just to correct the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Dabney. And Commissioner, I think the Sustainable Forest Initiative change here is going to be, we're going to continue to debate this. I would imagine you're going to take this proposal through the Environment Committee as well, because as Representative Bill rightly portrays, there's a lot of other issues related to this issue. You know, and I can say, those of us in the suburbs, you know, we've got a lot of people who like to hunt. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, in my community, our sworn officers shoot the deer yearly, and I mean I have 20-25 deer in my yard every day. We have them all around us. We don't get to hunt them, and for people who like to hunt, you know, it sort of break. They regularly will say, "Can't we hunt them?" You know, it's down behind my house in the river valley, and we don't allow that because we don't want people to get killed. You know, kids running through the woods. So our sworn officers do a program in the night where they bait and sign them and shoot them. And, you know, it's kind of a heartbreak to the folks who like to hunt, because then they drive up to where you all live and they do it there. But, I mean, you know, but depending, you know, where you live in the state, I mean, members may not realize how much of the suburb is heavily herded with deer. I mean, I had a mountain lion, a bobcat, shot behind my home by a police officer a couple of years ago that listened to the coyotes in the morning. We've got a litter. I mean, we've got all this stuff there. We just have, you know, we're a very dense population, so we don't have the hunting activity taking place. So I think around the state, people want to preserve those options and have to drive to do them, and they're willing to because they want to be able to do it. So I think we need to continue the discussion.
Yep. And Madam Chair, this will certainly be vetted by the Environment Committee in both houses. You know, just in a way of additional background, you made some good points about this, the acreage being held by some larger owners. I think 500,000, almost 500,000 of the 7,000 or 8,000 acres are held by those four large property owners. And this has been a very successful program. Just to put it in context, in 2002, there were 320 people enrolled in the program. And we paid out, the state paid out about $1.6 million. Fast forward to 2007, $6.1 million, 1,000 people enrolled in the program. So it probably has served its purpose. And we could have gone at this a different way. We could have reduced the amount. Instead of giving $861 to everybody, we could have done $5. Now that would have also impacted the smaller property owners, but we wanted to have that discussion about how to skin this cat. But this is a program that's been growing a lot. I mean, it's gone up fivefold in, you know, 6 years. And so we thought we should dial it back a little ways and still hopefully not undermine the intent of the program.
Thank you. So Jackknife and Tilch,
yes,
Federal Conformity, and the Education Check. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, page 21 is a reduction in appropriation that flows to the Iron Range, and it is currently in law, it's the equivalent of 22 cents per ton of the production tax. And we are recommending that be reduced to 7 cents, an appropriation of 7 cents, which is a reduction of $5.5 million a year. We currently send out about $8.5 million a year. So that's our recommendation. I believe Representative Rukovina and Representative Dill could speak about it, but I believe it was put in place in connection with LTV to try to backfill some of the lost production revenues. Our recommendation is to reduce that by $5.5 million.
Madam Chair, no. I already asked him why he didn't reduce the other businesses that got advantage of that by 66%, which he never answered. Clear.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukovina, this is a program that's been in place. It has not been cut in any of the governor's previous budgets. When we were looking at the whole universe of things that were on the table, this one, we hadn't cut it before, and we thought it was not unreasonable to reduce that by two-thirds. And it's one of the few appropriations that actually flows to the IRR, general fund appropriations. To a large extent, the IRR has been exempt from tax from cuts both in 03 and currently. In fact, this is probably the only that I'm aware of, at least, budget cut that actually will adversely impact that agency in any way. And so it wasn't just our first choice, but looking at all the other things that were being cut, we thought this made some sense.
But you never answered the question why you didn't think that the rest of the 2001 tax bill, this is where this was came out of, should be cut two-thirds.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukovina, we didn't revisit the 2001 tax
bill. You did right here.
No, we didn't. I mean,
this is exactly, I was in the room, and then Tim Pawlenty was majority leader, Deke Signal was speaker, Doug Johnson was taxer. I was in the room when they cut the deal. I know what it was cut about. It was cut because the mining companies weren't getting any of that property tax relief that was in the 2001 tax bill. So this was the way they all agreed to it. Tim Pawlenty agreed to this as majority leader. And now he's going after it and cutting it two-thirds. So I'm saying, fine, that's fine, do it. But then cut the whole 2001 education takeover by two-thirds, because you did it to one group. But there's this fairness issue again.
And Commissioner, in fairness, I'll just remind members that Commissioner Inos was not the commissioner then. Commissioner Salamone was, I believe. Right, Representative Rukovina. So I don't think Commissioner...
No, actually, it was
Commissioner Smith, I believe.
Smith, that's correct.
Right. Under Ventura. So this individual
was...
But
again, I'm just making a
guess. Representative Rukovina.
The point being, I think the governor's really politically smart. He never screws his friends. He screws his enemies, and that's why he's going after this money.
Are you the governor's enemy?
Well, I'm not. But I'm probably the only one at the table he has to come to the governor's mansion to play pool.
There you go. Okay, thank you. Tilt, wait on that. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Dill. I apologize. Representative Dill.
Are you saying then that this had nothing to do with this appropriation? Had nothing to do with the 2001 statewide commercial property tax reform that was in that bill in 2001, because I was in the gallery that day, sadly enough, and watched that bill pass when Representative Rukovina voted for the bill. And you voted for the bill, Representative Rukovina. I heard your speech. But nonetheless, I think that had more to do with property tax reform across the entire state, and you were backfilling something because the mines didn't pay, not because of LTV and the downturn in the economy and LTV closing. I'm just trying to make sure I understand this, because it's pretty important. And I'm not throwing up a red flag about the cut here, I agree with Rukovina, but I'd like to make sure I know what I'm talking about.
Commissioner, can you get us that information from revenue's perspective? I'm interested in that, too, as well, to try to figure out kind of how did that all play out. I think that's important going forward.
And Madam Chair, I will get that. That was the background that was explained to me in 2001, that there was a downturn in production on the range, and this was an attempt to try to backfill some of that. I think some would even argue at the department, at least, that it was always intended to be maybe a temporary until the cyclical nature of the mine turned around and production values went up. I mean, it begs the question, why put the appropriation in law as they calculated as a percent or a 22 cents per ton? And why not just give a straight out appropriation if it was, and that wasn't the intent? So I think our folks at Revenue, and Madam Chair, I'll get more background on that, always interpreted it as a way to help backfill when the mines were in debt.
No, Madam Chair.
Representative Zanino.
The mining companies got a rebate on taconite taxes if they invested it in their plant. And this tripled the rebate because everybody, other businesses were getting a rebate under the 2001 tax bill. And that's why it was described as a certain cent per ton, because it gave them about the same as other businesses in the state. And then we just passed it through to them, and they used it on their plants for fixing up their plants. And so now in the governor's proposal, he's taking two-thirds of the money away, but he's not taking, reducing that program that goes to the mining companies to fix their plants. Mm-hmm. Instead, he's jumped over to another fund where we give out money for economic development and public works, and saying, you guys take it from there because you didn't vote for me, and I'm going to sue you. That's why. And it's as simple as that. I understand that concept. I mean,
Commissioner,
you know, maybe that's nobody better than me at the table understands it, and that's the history of it.
But Madam Chair, Representative Rukovini, if you look at the statute, there is no reference in the statute about the TDEDF program, none. And so maybe the custom usage at the IRR has been to use that money for the refund program, but the statute merely says an appropriation will go out every year that's the equivalent of 22 cents per ton, and it said it will be distributed in the same manner as the current production tax. There is no reference in the legislation that this money is earmarked for TDEF. And I talked to Commissioner Lehman about it. It's become the custom and usage, and it's become what the board has done. And we applaud that program. We think it's an important program to encourage capital investment in mines. But the statute does not speak to that.
Master,
Representative,
you check and see what the TEDF fund jumped that year from what, how many cents per ton to 30, whatever it is, 31.5 or 30.5. And that's where the jump went for.
And Commissioner, we'll look forward to information on this. I think we all need it. So can you get through PILT conformity with China done anyway? And I think people get the K-12 shift. If you can get through those three in 5 minutes, you've made it through the whole thing.
Okay, Madam Chair, the PILT payment on page 22, and this is another, this is a reduction about 20% of the PILT payments that flow. Actually, we're just a pass-through agency. Actually, we get the numbers from the DNR, and we actually issue the appropriation. This would be a 20% reduction in the PILT payments that go out.
I got a question, Madam
Chair. Representative Jones. Yes, please.
I got a question, Commissioner. Is there, if a person doesn't pay the real estate taxes, penalty and interest charges to accrue on that until they pay? And then if they don't pay for a period of time, then the county takes over the land. Are there any provisions in law that allow the county to do that to you?
No.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
I think you know where I'm going.
Yeah, I do know where you're going, Representative Dill. Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I'm not aware of that. I would highly doubt it. Yeah.
We'll take another play. Yeah. In a playbook this year.
Thank you.
Page 23, Madam Chair. Federal conformity. You guys are pretty well versed in the federal conformity provision. This mirrors much of what Chairman Chesky has authored. The primary difference is you have the education expense deduction in yours. We do not propose that. It's about $1 million cost. You have a mechanism for paying for doing it immediately, which we applaud, and use the holdback of some of the corporate tax refunds in order to pay for that. We are supportive of the bill that the House is pushing through. We think that's a good way of going. We think it'll, you know, help tax compliance and make it a little bit easier for taxpayers to file. But in most instances, this is almost identical to what is going through the House currently.
Regarding the payment in lieu of taxes, does the governor, commissioner, support? You know, there's a lot of in the LCCMR request. I think there's about, I don't know, about 40-some percent of it is for purchasing new land. And so does the governor support using LCCMR money, or in the case of the new, the monies from the sales tax, paying that, putting some of that money aside for payment in lieu of, so we don't run into this problem in the future?
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, I'm not aware what the governor's position is, but I'd be more than happy to find out.
Well, you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do.
Madam Chair and members, because this is exactly what I brought up in the LCCMY when they were proposing to buy, I think it's about $11 million of their $25 million is being spent to purchase new property, and I said it's going to be very difficult, and Representative Lugini has argued the point too, to go to the Capitol and see that we're buying new land when the governor's probably, at the time he said, probably going to cut silt, which now he did. And so we take more land off the tax rolls, but we don't reimburse the local units of government. And, you know, it's going to also be an issue with the Ortho Heritage Council.
I agree.
And for some of us, they're saying, well, maybe you should get some of that money to manage in some kind of an endowment for the payment in lieu of, so we don't run into this time every time we get in a budget crisis.
It's a tough one. Representative Jill.
Well, the problem with what Representative Rukavina described is that the plant language. I mean, this is an obligation of the state that's already been made, and it says in there very clearly with the sales tax money that you can't plant other state appropriations with money. But it's going to be a problem, I think. And one last thing about silt is it's the same kind of an issue as the one we talked about earlier, the Sustainable Forest Initiative Act, except now it's the state that owns the land. It's not making the payments to local units. And I mean, when you have a legislative district that has millions and millions and millions and millions, I sound like Carl Sagan, mm-hmm. except that he is using
millions
of public land that mm-hmm. is receiving silt payments.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to talk about doing county program aid, local government aid, cuts and tilt. I mean, we're talking significant pain to those counties, and most of this is north of Highway 2. Almost all the SFIA land is north of Highway 2. Almost all the tilt land is north of Highway 2. So the focus is those three items in the north, where your folks are using the land. We're glad to use it. We're glad you come. It helps with our economy, to be honest. But it feels like we might have a target painted on us a little bit as this thing starts to develop.
Thank you.
I'm sure.
Representative
Rukavina. The point that Representative Dillon, I don't agree with you. I think that when you're purchasing new land, whether it's through the LCCMR or through this new Outdoor Heritage Council, I think people have to start considering that you just can't buy land and then just let it sit there. There should be some maintenance efforts to manage that land that's paid for with those monies, be it either fund I'm talking about, and there should be this full payment in lieu of idea. Maybe you can't go back.
I agree. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the payment in lieu of taxes on the land currently owned, using it to supplant that.
I think
that the money that is spent from the sales tax, that there ought to be at least three components. There ought to be, number one, an escrow, or some dedication of payment in lieu of taxes on the public land that we acquire in the future. There could be a forest management plan or a restoration plan for wetlands and things of that nature that is in place when we purchase the land, so the public knows that it's just not going to be some tract of land that has a minimal value, that it's going to be restored or maintained so that it has good public value. And lastly, we could have a proper recording of easements and agreements that this state very much lacks in, because we, as an example, Representative Cypher brought up the minnow in the Rules Committee, but that Representative Sullivan and I argued over. The DNR is issuing minnow trapping permits on land that are easements that are forbidden, but we don't have a good recording system for all of that. So those three things are really important as we look forward in the future, but you're using it to backfill the past. No.
Thank you. K-12 stuff, and then we're going to adjourn. We'll take public testimony on all the property tax stuff that we have. We took public testimony on all the corporate and business stuff. We'll take public testimony on all the property tax stuff on the 25th. So final page is the K-12 shift. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, the final page of the K-12 shift. This merely shows the property tax credit impact of going from a 90-10 payment to an 80-20 payment. And that's reflected here in a reduction in the first year.
All right, members, thank you. We made it through the governor's budget proposal. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.